dig the beard, if not for the words, for I am the unaccommodated man, naked, bare, a forked animal. Naked, bare, a forked animal, for I am the unaccommodated man. Dig the beard, if not for the words, for I am the unaccommodated man, naked, bare, and forked like an animal. Dig the beard, if not the words, for I am the unaccommodated man, naked, bare, forked animal. These are the words of Shakespeare, the true poet. Dig the beard, if not for the words, for this is the unaccommodated man, naked, bare, forked animal. Shakespeare, King Lear. Today we lay it all bare, dig the beard, if not the words, for we are the unaccommodated men, naked before you, bare, forked like an animal. It's time to lay it all bare, for I am the naked fool. Dustin, welcome to the User Error Program, your first time on the show. How the hell are you, man?
Very well, my friend. Thanks for the invite.
Thank you for wrapping yourself in a blanket, too, to help reduce the room noise. Much appreciated.
Warm and snuggy.
I think he was just cold.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You're on to me.
Yeah. What is the temperature up there?
Well, I'm going to say Celsius because that's what I know. It's probably about 10 in rain, so that's not too bad.
Okay. Now, in my brain, you're like, you're downtown Vancouver in a skyscraper. You have a view of the city where you sit there, you stroke the goatee, and you plot the future of Ubuntu Budgie. How close am I?
You're close. You're about 30 kilometers off, but, you know, you're pretty good otherwise.
You guys live in the minimalist lifestyle you told me up there, hence the room tone. Explain what that is.
Well, basically, we've kind of come to this conclusion that the moment you have a table in a room, it just gets covered in crap.
Jeez.
So, therefore, no table, no crap.
That is true. Just took the tables of Beard Nose. We had this table here in the studio that had this big brewing setup on it, and we had a table in the kitchen. Just had a whole bunch of crap on it. Took them both down the other day. I'm like, I'm tired of it. Get them out of here. No more tables.
And what happened to the crap?
Yeah.
Well, I've gotten moved or taken away or thrown away or assembled on the floor in a nice stack.
Well, then you just need to keep taking the tables away.
Yeah, something like that. Well, I had a really important question that I had to figure out before we got started, just so I kind of know where you stand on this.
All right.
Do you shave pre-shower or post-shower?
I shave in the shower.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. A curveball. You know, for years I've owned an electric razor that works in the shower, but the only thing I ever do with that is I just use that to rinse it off. I feel like if you're – my way of thinking it has always been if you're using an electric razor like and you're shaving your neck, you shave before the shower. But if you're using a blade with like some shaving cream – Beard, I know you wouldn't know. You don't shave. But if you're using like a real blade, you do that after the shower because your pores have opened up and it's like an easier, more complete shave. But if you do that same kind of shave with the electric razor post-shower, you know, you get some red patches. I've
Touché.
Gone through the last 20 years like this, right? Maybe plus. I mean, I don't have 25 years until today. Today, I use the electric razor post-shower. And I got to say, this is the least agitated my neck's been post-shave in ages. And I think it's changing everything I know. And I'm wondering if the next level would be in the shower. So why did you start with in the shower shaving? You didn't begin shaving this way.
No, it was, I don't know, let's call it efficiency. I'm in there anyways. That's the time when I, you know, like to get trim and proper. So,
right.
It's just kind of
you know
the
what?
Way
I
goes.
Have family members. You're not one of, are you one of these people? Do you also brush your teeth in the shower?
No, but let's just say that that's not necessarily just because of my decision.
Oh, so you got the lady vetoed that, huh?
Pretty much. I have done it. There's no lie there. But
disgusting bastard. I have family members that do the same thing. So okay. All right. You know, the whole range. It's shocking what people do in the shower. I know people that drink beer in the shower. That's when they prefer to drink their beer or their Red Bull in the shower. They think it makes it hit their system faster.
Okay, well, I guess you may as well just install a hot tub at that point.
Right? And a urinal, hopefully. Jeez.
It is kind of nice, though, because, you know, you got the nice hot shower and the nice cold drink.
Yeah, no,
it's a nice
I get
contrast.
It. Yeah, it is. It is. It just seems like, see, here's what I go for with my shower is I like the shower to be the cleanest place of a house. There's nothing cleaner than my shower. In fact, I have cleaning supplies at the ready in my bathroom that I'm all about. I go to Costco and I stock up on these things. I've had for the last 5 years in the studio these Clorox wipe pads that are like bristle pads with Clorox bleach in them that I can wipe down the edges to make sure all the stuff gets out. I like a nice, pristine shower. It's something so I feel like the more I do in there, you know, some people take a leak, some people brush their teeth, some people shave. I feel like all of those things add more grime to my shower, which reduces its cleanliness. And the core function of the shower is to make me clean. You know what I'm saying?
Definitely. But I'm also going to argue it comes down to what the materials of your shower are, because some of them hold stuff a heck of a lot more than other things. But like, for example, I have a tile one and it just cleans out super slick.
All right.
Yep.
All right. All right.
My new shower is a tile shower. It's great.
It doesn't get in like the little grommet area, like the little cracks?
Nope. No, not at all. Not if it's
well made.
Yeah, exactly. If it's done right,
sealed.
No way.
It's got to be sealed probably.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I just had to get that out of the way because I needed to, and you know what? I didn't expect the curveball, so I can tell this is going to be a good show. So the other reason why I thought it'd be fun to have Dustin on today is he's sort of becoming my fasting sponsor. You know, he and I sort of fast around the same time or intermittently fast, and we check in with each other, like, how are you doing today? How's it going? And so both Dustin and I are kind of getting back onto the fasting bandwagon after, for me at least, way too much time off. And we have talked about it a little bit here on the User Air program, and I was surprised that people seem to care. So we won't spend the whole episode about it. We'll just spend a couple of minutes so that way people who don't care don't have to suffer. But how are you doing? Are you fasting today, Dustin?
Today, not so much. It's just intermittent fasting today.
That's what I'm doing too. What's the difference between intermittent fasting and like fasting?
Well,
it's like partial starving?
Kind of, if you think about it. You're basically just eating within a set number of hours throughout the day. And the whole idea is to extend, you know, within reason, as long as you can throughout the day without eating. And the whole idea there is there's obviously some health benefits with fasting itself. But for me, it's just because I'm on the ketogenic diet. It's just trying to be efficient and not intake any of the carbohydrate and things like that and just be super efficient for as long as I can. So I just eat within, you know, a couple of hours. Yeah. If I do well, I mean, I can't lie. I say I'm intermittent fasting most days. I try to, but, you know, sometimes you fall off the wagon, but that's okay as long as you're eating the right thing.
Yeah. So for me, it's sort of the way I view it is if I was really busting my ass at a real hard job, like an intensive labor job, something that is more and more rare in the States these days, something that maybe would be more common 50, 60 years ago or even later, you would go 12 to 14 hours without eating, especially if you're out working somewhere in the middle of a field or on the back of a horse. You're not eating a lot. And it's sort of if you look at how much damn food we are surrounded by now, just take a moment when you go to get fuel or when you're driving down the road and all of the coffee stands and fast food restaurants and all of the convenience stores that are serving fried food and things in bags. We have an abundance of food as any civilization would, where their very survival depends on food. Of course, we have an abundance of food. We now have that luxury. But it is. It is still sort of tempting to that basic wiring in our brain. It's so tempting. It's so easy to just slip into eating too much. And so when you say I intermittently fast, well, really what that means is I'm not eating much during the day. I'm still having a dinner, but I'm just not eating as much during the day. And there's been this bro science that has really taken hold that says, well, if you do that, then your body will conserve everything the next time you eat, and it'll make you even more fat, and you'll gain even more weight, you fool. Don't you realize? And the reality is if you do something like Dustin was just saying, where you intermittently fast, and when you're not fasting, you eat a ketogenic diet, which is to say high in veggies and protein – and some fats, then it's really this sort of power solution that you will watch the weight just sort of drop off. You'll watch your energy level go up. And the really only downside is you got to be hungry sometimes, which is a bigger hurdle to get over than it sounds. There's like all these other benefits on the other side, but sometimes when you're hungry, it's distracting as hell. It's uncomfortable. You feel a little queasy. It is a bigger thing to get over than you might think. I am addicted to food.
Yeah, but the one thing I'm going to argue there, though, is when you're fasting, I think a big point as to how easy or hard or difficult it is for you is going to come from your diet, because everything you're saying is true if you're on more of the traditional diet. But if you are eating a higher fat diet, you're fat adapted and all that other stuff, it actually gets a lot easier. Like intermittent fasting, I don't even break a sweat. You just, because you're satiated, you almost aren't even hungry. Like I find that my hunger level has dropped off dramatically. I'm not craving foods anymore based on what I'm eating now. And it's just gotten way easier. And while when you transition from an intermittent fast to like a full-blown fast of, you know, 24, 48, 72, yeah, you have those hunger points because your body's still wanting things, but it is significantly easier. And that makes a huge difference, because if you're just eating like a traditional diet, well, no, that, you know, you could go into the science behind that of why or what or how without sounding like too preachy between like sugar cravings and all those other sort of things. You're fighting kind of like a double-edged sword of traditional hunger plus legitimate, you know, cravings, or in some people would specify addictions, right?
Yeah, and for me, it is a matter of convenience. Life gets busy, mm-hmm. and just the basic care of feeding myself falls to the wayside. This is not a humble brag or even just an example, and Beard knows this. I was here at the studio until 10:30 p.m. last night working, and I got in at 6 a.m. this morning to keep working because of the current show load. Right. There's not a lot of time when I'm working like that to go grocery shopping, to make meals. And so what ends up happening is I start falling back on like sugar-free Red Bulls, and which then just starts a cycle of incredible hunger. So then I have to do something about that. And so then I'm ordering a sandwich or something that can be delivered, and it really creates this cycle where I feel like shit.
Right.
And I also feel like I don't have any self-discipline, because I know that if I could just get to intermittent fasting and stay there. I've been many times where you're at, where I not only can I go all day without eating, but I have no desire to do it, and I'm often surprised once I'm at that stage at how much food I was eating. Like, why did I need three meals a day? I sit in front of a computer all day, then I walk to my truck and I drive home, and then I sit down again. Yeah. I go for walks once a day. There's nothing in that lifestyle that demands three meals. I'm not using that much fuel. But yet I've been habitualized, and at 10:30 a.m., my stomach has like, kind of gurgly hunger pains. 10:30 a.m., like a clock.
Yeah, well, a lot of that could also be a bit of habit combined with some, you know, desires, I guess. You know, like you said that you were, you know, a foodie, you like food.
I do.
So, like, don't get me wrong. So do I. Like, I went to...
Yeah, you're a good cook. I've experienced that firsthand.
Like, I went for lunch with Adam, who you know, the other day. He took me to a poutinerie, and I don't eat any of that. And it was so insanely hard not just to order the biggest damn bowl of poutine, because the restaurant, the guy's from Quebec. Like, that's
what he
where
does.
It originated,
that's
right?
That's his thing,
like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. And but the thing that helped me in general is simplification. So if you take away all that sort of stuff and you narrow down, and the unfortunate thing with a ketogenic diet is it's all or nothing. Otherwise you sabotage yourself, because the moment you start,
so true.
You start mixing things in, and you'll, you know, like if you're eating like high fat today, but then you're eating like carbohydrates the next day, well, guess what? You're not in ketosis. And now you're just storing and packing. So it's an all or nothing thing. And
the body prefers to burn carbohydrates instead of the more sophisticated fats, so the body will quickly switch back over to carbohydrates, because that's instant fuel essentially, where it's got to work to burn fat.
Right. It's our body is I don't know, you could call it lazy. You could call it efficient. It's the same thing with building muscle. Your body's always going to go where the easy burn or build is. So with food, if you're intaking sugars and carbohydrate, it's going to go there first. It's like, oh yeah, that's like, that's heaven. So it's going to go there. And then if you talk about building muscle, there's four types of muscle. I'm not super familiar with this, so I'll super high level it. But basically the 1A, if I'm remembering this correctly, is like what you'll get up to, like that's the type of muscle you'll build up to, I believe it's 70% exertion. So even when you're running, like this is the thing, like running is, okay, it's great for your cardio, but as far as weight loss and stuff, for, and this is just what I read. Obviously, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a nutritionist. I'm not some...
But you do play one on the internet, so that's good enough for me.
Okay, well, then I'm qualified. So you get up to this 70% exertion point, and you're not really doing much. Like, so you could go run 10, 15K, but you're still only at this exertion point. You'll be tired. Your muscles are hurt.
Oh, yeah.
But you're not
building.
We've
all seen this, like, when you're at the gym and you're exercising and the machine says, you've burned 100 calories. You're like, what? I've been going for 45 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. And then for muscle building and fat loss at each level, so then there's 1A, 1B, which I believe 1B is like 80% exertion. And then there's... Is it 2A and 2C? So don't get stuck on what I'm labeling them, because I could be wrong there. But the point is each amount of exertion you go up, your body builds into a new thing. So that's why, like, a lot of people talk about HIIT, like high intensity training, is being more useful for burning fat than cardio.
Because you're nailing that. Yeah.
Well, you put your body into a like a panic mode, like, because it's thinking like, I'm failing, I'm putting myself at risk, you know, like whether you say pretend you're hanging on the side of a cliff, and then apparently it triggers a whole whack load of hormones to start building muscle.
That's the same thing about starving yourself. That's the same thing with starving yourself. And the longer you starve yourself, the more that stuff sort of kicks in. And people that hear that go, Jesus, these guys are crazy. But think about this, Jerkhole. If your body could go 30 days without eating, do you think that's just accidental? Do you think that just stuck around through evolution for millions of years? The human body is extremely adaptable with, as long as you keep drinking water and, you know, salts maybe, you're going to be fine. Now, I'm not advocating anybody starve themselves, but my point is, it works for me because of my lifestyle. And my lifestyle is such that I'm sedentary.
Right.
I have a pretty sedentary lifestyle, more so than I'd like. Thankfully, I've got kids and I've got a dog and, you know, I have a fiance who likes to go for a walk. So these things keep me even more active than I would be if I was left to my own devices. And so as somebody who's tried gym memberships three or four times throughout my life, as somebody who's tried to stick to some sort of diet in the past, I've tried 30-day paleo, nothing has worked for me like a combination of intermittent fasting and eating ketogenic diet. And it's something that I'm going to try to do the majority of 2018. I won't do it all the time. I find it particularly hard when I'm like driving across the country in a single week in a tiny car. I find it extremely difficult. But there are – my goal is just to do it more than I'm not doing it in 2018.
Right.
And I think as long as you do the best – as long as you just try to do the best you can with this, you'll see good results.
Absolutely. I mean, if – like, to summarize it, within 6 months, I dropped 45 pounds doing nothing but changing my diet. I wasn't even fasting at that point.
Geez, when you're such a fat guy already. You're a real tubbo over there. What do you need to lose any weight for? I mean, really, Dustin, you should probably be eating more. Go get a milkshake.
No. Well, at this point, it's maintenance because, in context.
Yeah, that works too, right?
I've had a loosey-goosey last couple of, like, since summer, really, and it slowly starts coming back. It's just in the last week that I've gone all strict again, and I'm already down 5 in the last week just by going strict on my diet. So, there, and as you said, it is absolutely the easiest way to drop that I've found for me. Nothing else has worked, not even close.
See, the problem I end up having is that I can do the fasting part, but it's the keto part that I have a problem with. Like, I can't figure out.
You do love your pasta.
Yeah, I can't figure out how to transition to that, mostly cost effectively.
Yeah. That's definitely an issue. But so best way that I've sort of combated that is, one, I've simplified what I eat. That may sound boring in some ways, but if you stay on it strict for a while, your tastes legitimately change in what you enjoy.
I'm writing this down because I've been struggling. I just need a solution when it comes to food. So lay it out there, Brother Dustin. Give it to me. We got to go on, but this is really helping me personally. Yeah. So you got to give this to me.
Okay. So here's was sort of the steps I took to get into it, because historically I am a bread guy. I am a milkshake guy.
Oh, I love it. Yep.
All that
pizza,
stuff.
Like poutines.
Yeah, exactly.
A good burger.
a good, you know, sugary barbecue sauce on something smoked. Love it all. So I took it off in bite-sized chunks, no pun intended. And so the first thing was is I just started cutting my carbs, but I still ate what I wanted, like in the volume I wanted to eat. And then over time, the biggest thing that helped me too was I had to learn to cook. If you think that you're just going to go on this thing and eat bacon and eggs every day, which you can do, and it is easy, and you can keep it simple, but to combat the boredom, I had to learn to make variety within the parameters. Now, with doing that, though, I still keep it super simple. So I'll just give you some examples. I do a ton of grilling and a ton of roasting, you know, within the parameters of the diet, but I'll keep it simple. I try to avoid sauces. I try to, like, I want to make it quick and easy so that I don't get frustrated with the preparation. I don't want to get frustrated with the, you know, what am I going to have today?
Right. That is my number one enemy right now, is that.
So, for example, like what you could do, Chris, just having been at the studio and stuff, is you got the barbecue there. You could do a good chunk of your cooking at the studio on the barbecue and pre-cook a couple of things, like, you know, 3 days, 4 days worth of stuff. And so, for example, even if I'm not intermittent fasting and I'm eating lunch and all that, my lunches are insanely simple. Like, I will have a steak. I will have a helping of chicken wings or something like that, you know, maybe add some butter to it. And I'll intentionally keep my lunch insanely simple just so that I eat and I stick to it, you know, especially if I'm craving, right? So then when it comes around to dinner, I'll get a little more complex with the side dishes, but even that is insanely simple. I'll spiral some zucchini, throw some garlic in there, some butter, and maybe a couple of seasonings, and then grill something on the barbecue. Super simple. And at first, like, cutting down the variety of food sounds like insane, and it really does. But you do that at first just to get to that point where you're over the cravings. And then you start branching back out slowly, time permitting, as you learn things, and soon it just becomes normal. Like, that's really the way it is. It's just slow, small changes, but keeping to it, keeping to the strictness of it as to what you eat. You know, and if you're
steady progress towards it, you just keep refining it. That's how I found I got to intermittent fasting. First is I drop the energy drinks. That's the first step I take. I just go a week and I just stop drinking energy drinks. And then I go to just only like vegetables, meats, and fats for a week. Or maybe 2 weeks, even if I could really take my time, I'd go 2 weeks and I'd essentially transition to keto. And then after that, I would just go to intermittent fasting and I would eat once a day. And that wouldn't even feel like much of a transition going from 2 weeks of keto to that. It would just be really by that point, I would be eating less.
It's easy.
All right. There you go. That's okay. You want to finish? We got to finish it off because I know people that don't care are going to go nuts. But
yeah, for sure.
I was just saying, in your case, I'm surprised, you know, since you have the sous vide there, that you don't just, like, prepare a couple weeks of meals and just stick them in the freezer.
I get bored, you know, but...
But you can pre-prep a bunch of stuff. But whereas what I find, though, is, yes, you can drop things in the sous vide from the freezer, but the quality and the result just isn't quite the same. You know, like, you can do it, and if you're looking to make volume... Absolutely. Do it. Do what works for you. Do what's going to keep you on it. You know,
on the flip side, it's still going to be better quality than a sandwich from Jimmy John's.
Absolutely. Point taken. I'm just saying, like, if you're doing this for the long haul, like as a lifestyle change, which is hopefully what this is for me. I mean, I'm 4 years in with one break. So you get to that point where, so that you don't feel like you're always missing out, you start cooking and quality becomes a little important. It's still basic, like that's, but it's basic by choice. Yeah. I could do so much more cooking if I really wanted to, but to be honest, I don't want to. I've got other things I want to do. So it becomes, it's really about making your eating functional, not entertainment, I guess.
Yeah. I want it to always be fun, but I think you're right. It's, I can cook for fun sometimes, but I just gotta get regimented about it and find the time to do it. Speaking of that, it's time to move on. Last.ting.com. Go to last.ting.com. It's a smarter way to do mobile. The average Ting bill is just $23 per month. I've been a Ting customer for, I think, 722 years, although that's because I have a time machine. Probably shouldn't reveal too much about that, but friends, let me tell you this. I've been to the future, and I can tell you there is no better way to do mobile. It's just $6 a month for what you pay. Now, if you're Dustin, you can't have this. You can't have this. But us here in the United States of America can have this. It's a fair price for however much you talk, text, and data you use. And this Canadian company gives us nationwide coverage with no contracts and no commitments. There's no quote-unquote agreements. It's $6 for the line, Uncle Sam's cut, because God bless America, and then just pay for what you use. You can go into their control panel and see your usage at a glance. You can take complete and total control of everything inside the dashboard, and you can set usage and alerts. They have CDMA and GSM networks, so you can probably bring a device. You probably got one in the drawer. Or you can get one directly from Ting. Go to last.ting.com and take $25 off a device. Get yourself a Cadillac, or go get yourself a great budget phone, or even better, go off-grid with something that just goes in your pocket like one of them flip phones. You turn the stinking thing off. There ain't no GPS in that thing. What's that? Huh? They're still tracking you? This isn't how you... Oh, okay. I can't say that? Okay. Last.ting.com. Before we move off the topic of food entirely, I do have a fried Spam confession. I hit a low point today. The fasting hasn't been going well for me, and I knew with two shows I needed to keep the energy high, Dustin. I cheated this morning. I broke the fast.
Uh-oh.
And I dug around in the cupboard trying to look for something to eat here in the studio, because there's nothing.
Right.
Nothing that's good for you, at least. And I found a can of Spam from 2008.
Wow.
And I thought to myself, there's no way this is good anymore. But it is Spam, so it's possible. So I pull the Spam out, I flip it over on the bottom of the can. Best Buy, January 2019. Whoa. 2019. So I decided I would do a little fried Spam, and I want to give my fried Spam recipe here on the show. I think everybody in the user air audience should go out and get a can of Spam this week and enjoy it, because it's gotten a bad rap. You can buy that shit in 2008 and then eat it one random morning before you have to record two podcasts when you've been at the studio since 6 a.m. in 2018. If that's not investments, I don't know what is. I mean, that's a better investment than property these days. So here's my fried Spam recipe. You got to open up the can, you know, and then you just got to do this like a little shake and slide maneuver of the can. You just got to shake and slide the meat out of the box, and it falls down onto your cutting board. Slice it into prepared patty squares of your preferred thickness. You know, sort of like a soft cheese. You just sort of slice it like a soft cheese. And then I want you to get out a pan. Put that down on your stovetop and heat that up. Now, I want you to put your favorite oil in there, or a butter if you need to. And you just get that nice and hot. Get it sizzling. Then, once it's hot, you grab your new square patties and you throw them down on this. Fry these square patties up. Now, here's what I want you to do. I want you to listen to the sound. When it starts bubbling a little bit less, it's probably ready to flip. But you might also see the edges of your Spam patty brown. Just grab a fork. In my case, it might be a plastic fork, because who's got time to do dishes? And you just give it a good stab and flip it over. And brown the other side for a couple of minutes. Now, be careful, because that second side's going to brown faster. The last step, number 5. You take it out of the pan, you put it on your plate, and I suggest you serve it with your favorite sugary side sauce, like a ketchup or a barbecue. In my case, I did a hot mustard, just to kind of change it up. And if you've nailed the spam, what you'll get is you get a crispy outside, but this moist, squishy, gooey inside that only spam can offer. And I know that sounds a little weird, but I encourage you to try it. Here's a couple other recommendations. Grab a spam, cut it up, and then cut it again, cut it again, cut it again, and make cubes. You got spam cubes. Now fry up those spam cubes. Now take those spam cubes and throw them in some chili. Throw them on top of a salad. Friends, spam is for you, it's for me, it's for the poor, it's for the rich, it's for the Hawaiians, it's for all of us. Go get it. This is a free advertisement for spam right here. This is the User Error Challenge. By episode 44, I want you to come back and tell us how your spam adventures went. And you can use my fried spam recipe. I recommend it.
Here's my spam recipe. You take the can and you throw it in the trash. All right, Chris, you ready to take your truck and go live like a hobo down by the river?
Yeah, I am almost. I've been in the back of my mind for the last couple of weeks, talked about it recently on the show, kind of visualizing if I could live in my truck, not because I need to, but because I might try this for scale. This might be, you know, because we went to New York in Hadia's car. So now I'm going to iterate on that, go in my larger vehicle, and I'm going to put an air mattress in the back. So I have one of those, like, it's like a crew cab, so it's a larger truck cab. And it's got a larger bench back seat with more foot area. And I got an air mattress that goes down in the footwells. And I'm going to put an air mattress back there. I got a new inverter, 1,000-watt inverter. And I'm sort of – I got window covers to black out all the windows. I got a little portable Buddy propane heater that runs off of those Coleman green propane cylinders, those little ones. It looks basically like it's sitting on top of a mug that I'll use to heat the vehicle that doesn't require any battery power with the window cracked. So I'm getting set up to live out of the truck. But there's one area that I haven't figured out completely. I figure I need about 2 to 3 days of battery power. Now, obviously, I'll have the truck, and the truck has an inverter built into it. It's like a 115-watt inverter. So I've got some built-in power solutions, but I'm going to be trying to do shows from the truck. I'm going to try to have like a whole podcast. I'm going to turn this thing into a podcasting studio as well as a living space. I'm going to have if you've ever seen the vlog I did from Montana where Noah had his microphone mounted to his windshield, I'm going to set up the passenger area of my truck with a mixer, a laptop, and the microphone mounted to my windshield, and I need to power all of that. So I'm trying to come up with different options to have portable power that is also rechargeable when I have the ability to recharge it. It needs to be kind of flexible. And I can utilize the truck battery, but I can't just rely on that solely because then I won't be able to start my truck after I record a couple of episodes. So I've been like looking into this, and I'm not really an expert in this area. But I noticed recently something that could be an option. It's a little pricey, but Mophie, you know, the people that make the battery packs for phones, has just announced a Power Station AC, and it is a portable battery pack like you'd expect. It's a 22,000 milliamp hour battery. It's big. It's bigger than any portable battery you've ever seen before. It's like the size of a 7-inch tablet, but it has a little trick up its sleeve. It has an AC adapter built into the Mophie battery. So you can plug in things that just take AC power directly into this 22,000 milliamp hour battery. And it can provide like an hour of battery life to a 90-watt laptop. So say I'm editing and I just need to get by for an hour at full bore, I can plug this thing in and add an additional hour of capacity. It also supports USB-C PD fast charging for the battery itself and devices connected to it. And, of course, it has USB ports and all that stuff. It's if you get it from Amazon, it's like $160. But this thing is sweet. So that was one direction I was thinking. I don't know. Do you guys have any like portable power solutions that you like right now?
Nothing that's that portable, unfortunately.
Okay.
A lot of the time I've dealt with it in camping, it's just been like a little generator.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, I'm trying to avoid the generator thing. You know, if I had to, I suppose I could start the truck engine.
I do know that in cars, a lot of like longer term campers tend to do double or triple battery setups where they isolate the battery from the main battery so you don't drain the main battery.
Aha, so this is where I was thinking about going. I think I may do exactly that. I might use the truck battery for a couple of things, like maybe lights or charging some stuff. But the other route I'm thinking about going is my Dodge Ram has this really deep center console. It's more like a bucket, and like a square bucket. I'm contemplating, and I don't know enough, so I'm putting this out here because I want the audience's feedback. I'm requesting the audience's guidance on this. But I'm thinking about putting these quote-unquote high-performance, maintenance-free, sealed AGM motorcycle batteries, like maybe one or two, and they're essentially like a small version of a 12-volt car battery, but they're for motorcycles. And you could just run an inverter directly off that thing. And so I could have an inverter that's built into the truck that's connected to the truck battery. And then I have my other inverter, my 1,000-watt inverter, that could be connected to this motorcycle battery. It's a pretty sweet motorcycle battery. It's got 4.7 stars on Amazon. And one of the things I really like about it, it's got a voltmeter built into the top of it, which would make it easy for me just to stay on top of where it's at. And so you get this thing, and it's $48. So the Mophie is $200. And in reality, what that Mophie is it's a battery built into an inverter. It's a battery built around an inverter. And I'd be supplying my own inverter. So that's already – my dad got that for me for my birthday actually recently. And so I would just have to supply a $50 battery that I think would be much higher capacity than a 22,000 milliamp Mophie, although I don't really understand this stuff well enough. But the challenge, Beard, with that is how the hell do you charge that thing? There's like battery tenders, but they plug into AC outlets, which I won't have. And there's solar options, but they're like – I can get a 5-watt solar charger for $60, but that's not going to get me very far, and it's going to be a real slow charge. And I don't really know enough to wire this thing into my truck's alternator. So – you know, I'm really kind of a rookie and too much of a noob to really know which way to go. The Mophie seems obvious because it's simple, it's portable, it's easy to charge, and it's got the built-in inverter. But since I already own a nice, like, DeWalt 1,000-watt inverter, it seems like the better way to go would be to just get, like, a motorcycle battery that could fit inside somewhere in my truck that's totally sealed. So I'd like the audience's advice, because this is the problem I'm trying to solve now is power on the road, 3 days or so of power, then I figure I could probably get to somewhere where I could plug in and recharge stuff.
To me, it sounds like the motorcycle battery is the way to go, assuming you can get around how hard it is to recharge, because right. The last thing you want to do is be sitting there needing power at kind of, you know, what you may consider a critical time, and it's just not available. Then you're hunting right. for a power source. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the motorbike battery, if you can get it wired into the truck's alternator or something along those lines where it'll power up in a decent amount of time, you know, at least you've got some, you know, length out of it. And assuming every time you drive the truck, it's going to top up.
That would be perfect. I'm going to put links to all the stuff I'm looking at in the show notes. And if the audience out there knows more about this than I do, anyone does, I would love to get some advice. Let me know at ChrisLAS on the tweeters. Beard, you are getting into altcoins. I'm fascinated in that. Let's talk about that for a little bit. Screw this camping battery stuff. Altcoins, which one? I mean, are you just looking at one?
No, I'm doing the whole fancy profit switching stuff.
Now, what? So you're like jumping between coins depending on which one's more?
It's using the API to what coin to mine or whatever it is to figure out what coin is the most profitable for the setup that I have and mining that automatically.
So does one mining application support just shifting to different cryptos and they're all just running on your GPU, or how does this work?
Yes. I don't know if there's a Linux equivalent, but I'm using a app on Windows called Awesome Miner that will just automatically choose from like 100 coins that it has stuff programmed for. Like I just ran a benchmark against all the different hashing types when I first started it, so it has all that info, and then I entered in my power cost and the power that my system uses, and it uses that to automatically determine what is best.
Wow. That is sophisticated.
So currently the best thing for me to mine is a Z Classic using Equihash for $2.26 a day on my GTX 970.
So do you have cheap power at your new place? Is that what it is?
It is 9.5 cents essentially per kilowatt hour. So yes, that is relatively low compared to a lot of people.
Welcome to Seattle Hydro. Aren't you worried about the wear and tear though on like your rig?
I mean, yeah, but the thing that I figured is that I'm not able to use my main rig currently anyway, so maybe I can, you know, at least get enough money to finish my other rig.
Oh, I see. That's interesting, because you got a replacement rig in the standby.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. So burn this one to the ground, buddy. Yeah. I like, there's something, what got me originally into Bitcoin mining wasn't Bitcoin's price, because back then it was, I mean, when I first started mining Bitcoin, it couldn't have been more than $5. And so I just didn't do it for the price. I did it because I liked things like SETI at home and folding at home. I loved something about all of these anonymous nodes working together on a common network towards a common goal for their own individual reasons, producing a common result that is mathematically verifiable. There's something about that that really gets me going. I don't know what's wrong with me, but that it just makes me want to mine crypto regardless. And if I had enough time and an excuse to do it, like if I had some place to warm or heat, I would go for it. Are you noticing a lot of heat output? Are you? Because that was what I used to do. Is I used to heat the old garage studio mining crypto, and it legitimately worked.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because we've been trying not to use the heat. So, this is heat with another purpose.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and well, you think about it, when you turn on your
heat, and it pays for itself,
right? When you turn on an electric heater, you're heating up coils generally, and you're blowing air across it. You're burning the electricity, literally. So in this case, at least you're also making a slight profit from it.
Yeah, with the 970, I don't have a huge profit margin. It's like $2.26 for the best one at the moment per day.
How do you know you're not getting a bunch of like spyware, malware, rootkit, and screen scraping junk when you're installing these things on Windows? Like, I feel slightly better when I'm mining on Linux, just simply because that's not as much of an issue. But it seems like on the Windows platform, you're way more likely to step on a beehive.
Well, the good thing about this is I only need to install this one app, and a lot of people use this app, so I assume it's good.
I see. Okay. Yeah, of course. It's a really well-known app. Yeah. You're not going too, so in your case, you're not going too far off into the weeds.
Yeah, no. So I'm hooked up to a mining pool. I can't remember what it's called, but everything I mine at the end of every week on Sunday gets cashed out to Bitcoin and put into a single Bitcoin wallet.
Now, you're not mining all the time, obviously, because you're also using your machine to stream.
Correct. So I just mine. I usually mine when I go to sleep.
That's a good idea, because A, the machine's not doing nothing, and B, it's a good time to warm it up a little bit. Well, speaking of warming up, it's warming up for YouTubers. Don't worry, this is actually going to be interesting. But first, DigitalOcean.com. Go over there, create your account, and then use our promo code of authority, Here's the Thing. Now, here's the thing, everybody. DigitalOcean is a simple cloud hosting provider dedicated to offering you an easy way to spin up a base system or an entire application stack. Managing infrastructure at DigitalOcean is a snap. They can take that, actually. Guys, run with that. That's good. DigitalOcean just gets out of your way. It lets you build and deploy in seconds. It makes it possible for teams to work together, and it has the best dashboard in the business to make it all happen. They have infrastructure that is going to blow you away. It's what they begun. They begun on. It's what they begun on. They begun on that. They began with
Chris. Chris.
What?
I have an inside scoop for you.
What?
If you have a droplet, and you turn off your droplet,
mm-hmm.
You can upgrade your droplet for free now.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's right. They're kicking off the new year with new pricing, like more memory, more disk. It's great. My favorite rig now, the 3 cents an hour system, has 4 gigs of RAM, 2 CPUs, and an 80 gigabyte SSD for 3 cents an hour. Oh, I like that. This is such a cool setup. Go to DigitalOcean.com, create your account, and use the promo code Here's the Thing. You apply that to your account, all one word, you get the $10 credit. Why not play with a 3 cents an hour one? Or like Beard said, if you got an existing machine, shut it down and upgrade it. Take a look at the dashboard, deploy free BSD or Ubuntu or Fedora or Debian. Look at their clustered deployments, their team accounts, their monitoring and alerting, and all of the pre-built applications that are just one click away. It's nuts. I don't know how they do it. Perhaps they have a time machine. DigitalOcean.com. Go over there and use the promo code Here's the Thing. Man, YouTube's really turning into a shithole, and now YouTubers are begging their fans to just leave the videos on in the background so that way they can hit higher levels of hours watched, so that way their channels don't get demonetized because of Adpocalypse. What is this, Beard? 3 now is coming to the YouTube platform?
Yep. The first Adpocalypse was the whole, demonetize everything because content's not appropriate. And the second phase was what's-his-name doing the video in the suicide forest, and this is phase 3.
Right. Do you remember the Jupiter Broadcasting backstage channel where we had my head bopping video on? We had a bunch of like stoked outtakes on that channel.
Yep.
That got hit by this. Not a big deal, but it's kind of unfortunate because that video of me head bopping has gone viral a couple of times, and so it was nice to have ads on that. YouTube said, no, you're not worthy, and we're demonetizing this entire channel now. Which, you know, fair enough, screw YouTube, but it is going to hurt people.
All you got to do, Chris, is play that head bopping literally on every computer you own 24/7.
Right, exactly. Now, Twitch isn't failing to notice YouTube's predicament and manages to sort of kick YouTube while they're down every single time. And they're launching new video producer tools and apparently a partnership with Disney to produce exclusive Twitch content, which is the name of the game these days. You know anything about this producer tools for Twitch and if they're anything worth talking about?
No, I had actually not heard anything about it. That's news to me.
Look at me bringing you, Mr. Streamer, over there, the Twitch news. You hear that, Dustin? Did you hear that?
There's proof.
That, right?
There's proof.
Yep, it's proof right
well,
there.
Well, to be fair, it sounds like that's for like pre-produced content, though.
I hate you. You know what? You take away my nice things every damn time.
But, you know, that's good news for you because that's more reason for JB to get on Twitch.
Yeah, so they're going to have – you're going to do premieres, which is interesting. You can do lives, and you can put your stream now in a rerun mode, which – how awesome is that for us? Because that is a huge point of confusion for people. Is this live or is it in reruns? People just don't get it. And to be able to just put the whole channel in reruns mode is brilliant, actually. I do like that. You can also create landing pages for that stuff. You can set reminders for some of the users that subscribe. All that stuff's really cool. So Twitch does seem to be trying to capitalize on YouTube being a real piece of crap these days. I'll be interested to see where it goes because there's not like a free open source peer-to-peer competitor that's really taking off. I'm sure Mastodon will do it one day.
Okay, yeah. The premiere stuff, the rerun stuff has already been there, but the premiere stuff, they mentioned back at TwitchCon. It looks like they're just consolidating all under one roof now.
So have you thrown the bag in on the streaming, or are you doing the only other logical thing and going all in?
I'm going all in, of course.
What else
would you do?
So you're still streaming every day?
Yeah, I'm on tonight will be day 23.
Whoa.
Also, at the beginning of February, I have not picked a particular day yet. Depends on what the schedule looks like. But I will be doing a 24-hour stream. So nobody has any excuse to not come see me.
What kind of maniac reason do you have to do anything for 24 hours? What are you doing over there for 24 hours?
Well,
what is happening?
A, to grow my channel. Because, I like doing this and I want to do things.
Sure.
I may or may not have a secret sponsor for this stream that is going to allow me to give away $200 in rewards I'm thinking maybe to people that subscribe to me. So you basically like pay $5 or use your Twitch Prime and you get a chance at getting some amount of stuff. I haven't decided how I'm going to divvy it up. If it's just going to be one big prize or four prizes or one big one, two small ones.
That sounds pretty sweet. That sounds like a good use of somebody's Twitch Prime, really. Okay, so what? Your Twitter feed, rec.net. How do I get on this goodness? Because I'm going to win all of the prizes. I'm going to create 35 shell accounts, and all of them are going to subscribe using people's stolen credentials, and I'm going to get one of these prizes.
That's a lot of Amazon Prime. So Twitter is probably the best way. Alternatively, you can join my Discord if you have Discord.
Maniac. Okay. All right. Where's that at? Come on.
If you want my Discord link, you can just go to my stream at any time and type in Bang Discord and I'll give you the link.
Okay. All right. So, Dustin, when you're not streaming, I know you're working. You're taking care of business over at Ubuntu Budgie. And so you're kind of you're a hip guy. You know, you're following the trends. And so I'm wondering how this appeals to your minimalist sensibilities. It's a smart home, but it's a completely prefabbed, totally pre-tricked out smart home. It's like a container home that arrives, snaps together, and it's ready to go. But it's not like your grandpa's container home. It's something that's totally different. It's from Shelter Dynamics, a California-based modular housing company. And it has curved roof lines with efficient windows and nice walls garnished with anchored doorways, recessed lighting, built-in seating and storage, and all of the smart stuff is just built right in. Speakers, lighting, cooling, window shades, all of it just is integrated right in there, and then you hook up an Echo to it. It's got a smart furnace as well, of course. Everything's on a smart plug. It's got smart locks, and it's all just baked right in and controlled with the Echo.
Well,
what do you think of this idea?
I don't know. It's somewhat viable, but the first thing, like, you know, let's just pretend Noah's on the show for a second. Is it hooked into a cloud service? Can you still use it if that goes away, right? As for the prefabbed portion, I have absolutely no problem with that so long as the quality's there.
Yeah, actually looking at it, it looks like a really high-end RV, maybe even more so because it's probably using heavier materials. It's about 125 U.S. greenbacks to 150 U.S. greenbacks, depending on how many like smart things and what all you get built in.
What's sort of the sizing on them?
The Flex House, as it's called, has various different floor plans. There's like two. Two floor plans.
That's variety.
Depending on which variety you want, but they didn't put down the bigger one, but the smaller floor plan is 760 square feet, which actually is pretty big for a tiny home.
Yeah, that's not bad. I mean, I'm one of those people that I actually subscribe to a lot of that sort of stuff that's up and coming, whether it's the small house or the prefab or you know, off the grid sort of stuff. It's all super appealing to me. The wifey and I have actually kind of decided when we get to that point that I think we're going to build an A-frame somewhere maybe. But the whole idea is, you know, keep it around, you know, maybe 800 square feet at most, super optimized living space, everything built in. And honestly, if I could have it, you know, all smart and in a good way that's a little future-proofed, I would be severely down with that.
Yeah, me too.
It's almost too hard to do the smart home in an existing large house. When I look at doing it, it's like I look at the number of walls I have to rip apart just to do the infrastructure part of it, you know, just not to either overload the Wi-Fi or actually have a great experience or something that's, you know, foolproof so that, you know, it works when you want it to work, you know?
Yeah.
That is almost daunting and overwhelming. And by time you drop your cash on purchasing said house, and then it's like, oh, I got to go and rip it apart. No. That just doesn't really appeal to me. So if you could get something out of the box that actually supports all of this, I'd be down.
Yeah, your point is well taken about the cloud services and what happens when they move on and all of a sudden you can't turn on the lights or shut your shades or unlock your door. And I feel like these companies need to come up with some sort of social contract or some kind of agreement when you buy the device that this is going to have 10 years of services.
Right. Or a fallback.
Something. Yeah. Or a fallback system or some sort of fallback guarantee.
Yeah. So, I mean,
offline mode, but really, maybe even more ideal is offline mode built right in from day one.
Yeah. And with a way to keep that going for the foreseeable future. I mean, I would like to believe that if I buy a house that, you know, I'm going to live there until either A, I sell it, or B, I kick the bucket, right? So, which means the technology's got to kind of keep up. Well, not keep up with it, but at least be functional. You know, you buy a house, you want the light switch to work, right?
So that's why I really wish I wish HomeKit could be an industry standard that went well beyond iOS, because, you know, the RV is a very small space. And so it only took me 7-8 months of just slowly replacing devices to automate and make quote unquote smart device things everywhere. And so there's just so much of it is controlled now with smart devices that it really does make it simple when you don't have a, you know, 3,000 square foot home to take care of. And in so doing so, every now and then we're in an area where we don't have internet service because we're in an RV, and it is immediately apparent with the Echo. It's just completely unusable. You can't even get the time. You can't turn anything on and off. It just says, sorry, I'm unable to connect to the Alexa service. Where HomeKit devices continue to operate over the LAN, don't require any cloud connectivity. We can literally just have our internet turned off. I can have the MiFi just off, and I can still control all my smart devices with my phone using the buttons on the phone, you know, because they're just a gesture away on iOS. And I find that to be much more sustainable, because it reminds me that I have complete control over these. Even when I have my internet physically switched off, I can still control all these devices. And the Echo is instantly unusable to even just to the point of telling you what time it is. It doesn't even have a clock. It can't even do that. It can't batch request for when the internet comes back up or anything. And if your home is predominantly controlled by all that stuff like mine is, that really does matter.
Yeah, absolutely. Like it's almost a showstopper. Like you need, like, I guess if you want to talk about fundamentally where, say, I personally sit on this home automation stuff, like I do like sort of the approach that Noah's taken with it. Like he's very mechanical, or at least he prefers mechanical on off sort of things, which is good. But I personally also want some of the newer features, but they just need to sort of, again, they need an escape hatch or break the glass sort of situation to where it's at least still usable in an acceptable capacity, and it is very transparent about what is going to be available if, you know, service A goes away or function B goes away or whatever. It's just has to be transparent so you can make that educated decision to purchase, and especially at the scale of a house.
We're way away from that right now. We're far away from that, and the market doesn't seem to be demanding that, so I doubt we're going to get it.
So I've been doing a bit of research while you guys were talking. If it's anything like their previous smart home that they did, it is using the AT&T smart house system. So it's probably only online.
Well, that was their last one, yeah. But this one, the central control point is the Echo now, which is the new thing. That's the sort of new thing that they're doing, is instead of using AT&T, they've switched to using the Echo, which I think is sort of noteworthy, don't you? I mean, doesn't that seem like a data point just in terms of market trends too?
Yeah, I suppose.
Well, absolutely.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I guess the thing is if you want to know if these things are useful and why voice control does matter and why you can't have everything just on mechanical switches, if it's cold where you live and it gets cold where you sleep at night, the surefire, this is obvious, how did I live without this use for these lady tubes, is get a little cheapo electric space heater or whatever and put it on a smart plug. Make sure you get one that you can just physically switch to on, so that way when its power source goes live, it turns on. You don't want one that has like a digital button that you have to activate, because that's going to ruin it. So get one that's physically switched on all the time, plug it into a smart plug, connect it up to a lady tube, and when you're laying there in bed freezing your nuts off, the fact that you can just barely above your breath mumble at the lady tube and say, turn on the bedroom heater, and she hears you, and she turns on that bedroom heater without you even having to speak up and enunciate, and it warms up your room, and you fall back asleep, and you get another 2 hours of great fucking sleep, it really makes that $30 dot and that $30 smart plug worth it. And I have one in my room right now, And that's what I use it for. And if it, sure enough, if it's not helping me get significantly better sleep, if I start getting cold or reverse, right? I start getting too warm. I just reverse it. Hey, lady tube, turn off that bedroom heater. And it's off. It's done with. It's the best thing ever. And that's just, I have lamps that are set low. I have a LifeFix bulb that's set to 20% light that I can say, turn on the nighttime light. So if I got to get up and take a leak, I'm not blasting light. All of these things are life improvers, and it really demonstrates the use for voice. When you walk into your home and your hands are full and it's dark and you say, hey, turn on the lights, and you don't have, you know, you can just set the groceries down and keep working. You don't have to even take a beat. You don't have to, like, brush the bag up against the switch. It's nice. And you just take all these little tiny micro situations and times it by 1,000. And that's what it's like to have these things once they're fully integrated. They're going to come built into homes. They're going to come built into hotel rooms. They're going to come built into RVs. It's by 2020, these things are going to be listening to every fart, every time you masturbate, every time you F the old lady. It's all going to be captured by a lady tube, because the reality is they get triggered all the time. I was just kvitching about how much damn money Amazon's making these days from AWS. And sure shit, the lady tube was activated the whole time. So they have a conversation of my Amazon account sitting there cracking jokes about how much damn money Amazon makes these days. I would be surprised if, when you're talking about Amazon, that doesn't get recognized by their system. That would seem like an oversight on their part. These incidents happen. So get ready.
It reminds me of that Black Mirror episode where the husband passes away, and based on his social media, his interactions online, they build out an entire profile that you can interact with your deceased loved one
based on. Yeah, I really feel like that's going to happen.
Yeah, it's probably closer than we think in some weird way.
Oh, all right. Do you guys want to do a little tech news before we wrap it up? A little tech news.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Dustin, since you're our new guest, if you want to toss one into the ring, take your favorite story of the week and toss.
Sure. Well, sort of the first one that sort of stuck out at me is just the one that Joey posted over at OMG about the native Linux app development and decline. It just kind of poses an interesting sort of point of view and something to think about, because at first thought, I never had that sort of consideration. Like, to me, it doesn't feel like it. It feels like we have almost more apps than ever. Like, the Linux desktop is insanely usable these days compared to even 5 to 10 years ago. And part of that article that I found a little odd is they sort of separate off Electron apps a little bit, not really, but I mean, regardless of the framework you're using to present it, still an app. I would say it's actually increasing, not declining, maybe decline of, native. Yeah, definitely. Like he's talking about, but apps in general, no. Native, maybe.
Well, definitely more. I think it's been two things. You know, as somebody who used to have an abundance of choices, and then over the years, one of the things that would take the most time towards the end of the Linux Action Show was finding an app pick. And it got to be a real grind. And, you know, I'd have to try three or four things before any of them were even worth talking about. And when we created the app pick segment, it was from an abundance of too many applications to talk about that we can't even do an episode on all of them. So we're gonna just cram one in the beginning of the episode too to tell you about. It went from that to this stressful, long, agonizing search for the application. But to me, it was not Electron. It started way, way before Electron. It really started when web applications started becoming more common, and then mobile. It was like this 1-2 punch that really took the momentum out of, I think, native desktop. And I think there's other transitions too, like the transition to GTK 2 to 3 happened around this time, and we spilled a lot of momentum there. Qt 4 to 5, you know, these transitions struck all around the same time that web application development was on the rise and mobile development was on the rise. Meanwhile, our primary desktop toolkits were sort of in transition. Our desktops were in transition. I think Electron is just the result of the sort of natural foregone conclusion of all of that kind of coming to where it's at now.
Yeah, it was kind of a perfect storm that sort of driven it in this way. More what I see that is kind of the issue at times is the quality of the applications, not necessarily what framework or how they're built or not even like a feature set, but just the quality, like the user experience, how well it's sort of put together. That sort of seems to be the thing to me that's sort of lacking at times.
Yeah. A lot of times it feels like we've started over one too many times. And so a lot of things are a little more alpha than they should be. Like when you think about how old the desktop computing is, these things should be really tried and true at this point, because it turns out we're a few years into the desktop computing platform. But when you look at desktop toolkits and core technologies, well, we've been rebooting some of them, and then we've been refining and retooling them and adding features back into them at a slow but steady pace. And I guess when you look at web technologies and when you look at mobile technologies, I would say they're anything but slow and steady. It's sort of phenomenal about how many different toolkits there are for the web, how many different frameworks there are. It's insane how fast mobile devices have been progressing. It really gives developers something to chew on. It gives them something to innovate on. It gives them something to get people to buy the new versions of. I think that's helped them quite a bit. And then you get to a point where it's good enough.
Yeah.
And you know, that's where Windows is.
True. The other factor is, too, is if you look at the acceleration of web apps and toolkits and all those various other things, part of that probably, if you think about who was writing native apps back in the day, it was probably, you know, that more dedicated computer-centric person who is interested and dedicated enough to actually go learn the language. Whereas something like web development before it sort of became all about applications. I mean, it was very approachable. People got interested in it just for, you know, putting something up on the screen and having it on the internet. And it was sort of this iterative process that people sort of got their feet wet at that super high level. And then over time, by time everybody could build a web app, now there were these frameworks that you could just take your existing skill set and just bang, all of a sudden, oh, I'm building my app. It's running everywhere. I don't have to really worry about X, Y, or Z. Oh, cool. Half the work's done for me. I'm on my way. It was approachable. Whereas if you look at people coming new to native development, like it's much more, you know, sort of daunting to the new person who's maybe not either genuinely passionate or outside of the community. You know, like if you're going to go pick up C++ and Qt today, like, you know, like you got to be ready to really learn that.
Yeah. And it's going to take you years at that to become a good developer, to make good applications. And so it's this entire context and the market dynamics of keeping things cheap and efficient that brings us to Electron today. And that's why it is simply inevitable, because it's not a choice. It is almost like the accumulation of 10 years of momentum in this direction. And Electron is just the natural result of developers needing to write once and try to run everywhere and trying to get that work since Java was in the sperm of Sun to now, where we need to write for Macs and we need to write for Linux and we need to write for Windows and we need to be connected to web services anyways, and half our shit's going off to APIs. And so all of these things just come together to bring us to market conditions to have something just like Electron. And if it wasn't Electron, my God, it could be even worse. It could be something based on Flash. I mean, looking at all, there's probably a mirror universe where Flash became the new Electron. Somehow Adobe pulled a rabbit out of a hat. And they got Steve Jobs on board back in the early days, and they got the whole world on board with Flash, and it could have become the pervasive runtime. They had a go at it. They had a go at it with Air, and it could have happened.
That alternate reality sounds around 2000.
Yeah. I mean, that could have been it. And if their timing would have been different, I'm not here defending Electron, but my point simply is it was inevitable. The market was taking many, many shots at it, and the harsh market dynamics just force it upon us. And it kind of brings me down a little bit. So we're going to move on from that, because that's a sad story. That's sad.
Yeah, yeah. It's just the modern day cross-platform versus previously Flash was cross-browser. That's really what. Yeah.
And in some ways, you got to be grateful, because there's some great apps that we have on Linux now because of it. And we're talking on it. It is making our very discussion possible right now.
Bingo.
So we should keep that in mind. All right, Beard, did you have a tech story of the week that love Ovid?
It's finally happening, Chris. Probably from the person you'd want to do it the least, though. Apparently, at the World Economic Forum, the Uber CEO has told us to expect flying cars within 5 to 7 years.
Oh, brother.
They're planning on doing Uber Air.
My butt, dude. They're not going to be cars. We'll get to Mars before we have flying cars. That's my personal prediction.
It's funny you say that, because apparently this is part of a partnership with NASA. Uber is looking to develop robotic flight systems that would operate set routes between cities. Dubbed Uber Air, the network would allow customers to travel in high-speed flight in and around urban areas.
Okay, I got to look this up. Is this a thing? Are there pictures of this?
There's no pictures yet.
Uber Elevate.
I know there's some other companies that are already trying to develop like the two-person, four-person little self-automated drones. Like I know there's a couple of spots out of China that they're working on it for personal transport.
Like a passenger helicopter. If you go look up Uber Air on images, you see like different like concept shots of essentially a helicopter airplane combo that looks like it could fit 2 to 4 people.
They just want supercharged autopilot.
Oh my gosh, they have okay. This is always a roll of the dice when you're doing a show. This is like the ultimate roll of the dice, but there is an Uber Air or an Uber Elevate video. You can also download the white paper. So before we download the white paper, let's take a look. All right, it's two ladies walking through an office space. She says goodbye, pulls out her smartphone. She opens up the Uber app and confirms an Uber Air transport. But instead of looking at the cars, she looks up in the sky. There's several planes flying around. She goes inside a nearby partnered business, walks into the elevator, hits the top floor button, takes a quick ride to the top, where people are coming and going, scans the Uber app as she walks through the gates, and she walks up to the most futuristic, badass-looking helicopter plane I've ever seen. It's comfortable, it's connected to an electric charger, it's got lots of window space, and a blue LED light ring out front. It takes off from the surface of the building, and then after it's up in the air and it's going, the wings pivot like a Klingon bird of prey. She looks down at all of the idiots in traffic. Smugly looks down at all of the idiots in traffic again. Looks up at her ETA, where her dickbag captain is giving them an update, while kids swing down below as she flies overhead, above it all, watching them. She lands at the receptacle at the airport. She gets in a taxi, and she's home to see her little girl before all of those suckers in traffic even made it a mile down the road. Her handsome husband has dinner ready to go, and the drone shot takes off as the sun sets. They go to bed, and Uber Air flies overhead. Wow. That's quite the dream. That's a bigger dream than Amazon delivering packages with drones.
I feel like they have to be closer than they're letting on, because they've already announced 3 cities: Dubai, Dallas, and LA.
Oh, of course Dubai's in there. Oh my God. The hype is strong with this one. I love it. All right, well, you know what? The moment it happens, I'll take an Uber Air up to Vancouver, and I'll have dinner with Dustin.
There you go. You better get on that, man. It can be yours for only $399 per flight.
No, apparently, according to this, it's going to be the same price as an UberX.
My balls, dude.